A lot of entrepreneurs have problems with managing their team. You can't manage what you don't measure, and you can't improve what you don't measure. The biggest thing that I think triggered me to achieve a lot of things was...
How do you go from an immigrant with nothing to completing 17 Ironman races and selling a multi-million dollar business? Our guest today's story will inspire you to embrace adversity, master resilience, and achieve what feels impossible. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead because we believe that great leaders aren't born or made, we're constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby, a two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Stephen Pivnik, an entrepreneur, endurance athlete, and advisor who embodies the grit and resilience it takes to succeed. In my conversation with Stephen today, I'm going to ask him to share his journey from immigrating to the U.S. during the Cold War, how he struck out on his first 2 attempts at startups, but hit an absolute home run in his third, and how endurance sports helped shape his mindset that led him to be a super successful entrepreneur over the years, and so much more. Okay, well, let's start with, you immigrated to the U.S. during the Cold War, started with nothing, built and sold a multi-million dollar company, and completed over 17 Ironman races. How did stepping out of your comfort zone shape who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I just, witnessed what my family went through. Talk about, being uncomfortable. I've heard the story and have seen so many pictures of the immigration process, leaving Odessa, living in Italy for 6 months, not having a penny to our name, finally being taken to the United States by this organization that was supporting the immigration. And just, witnessing that grind, witnessing that struggle, and witnessing incredible times of uncomfort, I believe definitely contributed to, shaping what I ended up doing in life, which is getting uncomfortable in order to be successful.
No, absolutely. And I just kind of wanted to start there. So you left the Soviet Union, the heart of communism in what, the late 60s, early 70s?
Or 1971, to be exact.
1971. Wow. So what was that experience like for your family?
Yeah, it was tough. And again, I'm repeating these based on stories because I was only 2 years old. I actually remember what happened.
Good point.
But anti-Semitism was alive and well in the former Soviet Union. We lived in a town called Odessa, which is Ukraine, at the bottom of Ukraine now. And anti-Semitism was rampant. The straw that, not that we were, ultra-Orthodox Jews, but we practiced, the high holidays and some of the bigger customs. The straw that broke the camel's back was a woman approaching my grandmother at a store and breaking a bottle over her head, calling her a dirty Jew, because my grandmother wanted 2 dolls instead of 1, because my grandmother had 2 twin girls, my mother and my aunt. So because she wanted 2 dolls when everybody was allocated 1, communism.
Yeah.
She was called the dirty Jew with a bottle broken over her head. And then at that point, my grandfather said, no mas, we're out of here.
Yeah. And then you first went to Italy or Austria, Italy, and then you ended up in New Jersey?
It's Brooklyn, New York. So at the time, Rome, Italy was the central processing center for all Eastern European immigrants that wanted to entry into the U.S. So you needed to wait your turn in Italy in order for your paperwork to be processed and your visas to be approved. That process took 6 months. And there's a great documentary called Stateless, because when we left the Soviet Union, we needed to give up our citizenship there. And we didn't have any status in any other country. So we were literally stateless for 6 months, like refugees, and just waiting for our visas to be approved until the day finally came. And we got on that wonderful flight to JFK in New York.
Now, I know you don't remember what it was like at 2 or 3 years old, but watching your parents start over, both your mom and your dad, and working tirelessly, and I heard you share in your book and everything about how there was never a sick day. So let's talk a little bit about some of those experiences and how it helped shape your mindset.
Sure. I mean, I love the word grind because, I've witnessed the grind over and over again. And I think you learn the grind by witnessing the grind. And that's exactly what my family did. Like I said in my book, I don't remember my father ever staying home from work, ever. Except if it wasn't a Sunday, he was at work. you know, Monday through Saturday, he was at work. I remember him coming home, you know, coughing up a lung, being really in bad shape, but he was coming from work. So there was no such thing as not working. And same with my mother, you know, she grinded it out. My grandfather did. He was a school bus driver for a school. And it was just, you know, the continuous immigrant type lifestyle to try and make it in the new place.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And when I hear stories like that, I like to reflect back a lot, Stephen, on how fortunate I am to live in America, right? But I think, unfortunately, a lot of people just take it for granted. So from your perspective, what is it like? What are those opportunities that are out there that what you've seen from an immigrant's perspective on what the opportunity is like here in America?
I mean, that's a great point, Damon. It's people do take a lot of things for granted until, you know, things are taken away from them. You know, you really don't realize how many freedoms we have until you don't have them. My father, before my father's full family immigrated here, he wanted A, to go visit them, B, to show me and my sister where he grew up and where I was born, where my mother was born as well. So we went back to Odessa this was in the early 80s, approximately, early to mid 80s, when, you know, communism was alive and well, and food lines were happening. You had to be careful what you said. You know, we had KGB agents trailing us. We saw them in the corner.
Really?
Of the hotel. Yeah, we came down from our hotel that we were staying at because we didn't have a lot of money, but we could afford an okay tourist hotel in Odessa when we stayed there. And when we came down for breakfast, sure enough, there was two guys in gray suits in the corner. And my father told me all of this afterwards because he didn't want to say it there, but they were listening in on our conversation and following along. So afterward, and I thought that was a really, really eerie feeling to know that that was actually happening. Our rooms were probably bugged. Anyway, I think a lot of times we take our opportunities and our freedoms here for granted, and we shouldn't, because this still is, you know, the best country in the world. And there's just so much that is available to us. People should take more advantage of it.
No, I appreciate you saying that. You know, for those of us who were able to grow up here, we are really, really fortunate. And I really believe, I think a lot like you do, that if you work really hard and you set large goals, you can accomplish them, right? You can get them done, but you got to put in the effort and the work to do it. Before we move on, is there any particular story or experience that you remember from your childhood that also helped shape this resilience and hard work?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that I think triggered me to achieve a lot of things was the wealth disparity that I witnessed in school. I guess modern day terminology for it would be bullying. I wasn't really bullied per se, wasn't violent, but I was made fun of because I was the poorest kid in school. The ritzy school that I went to, the other students there didn't know that I was there for free on an immigrant scholarship. And they would say things like, we'd walk in after spring break and they would be in their new pastel colors and all their new wardrobes. And I'd walk in and they would, the most popular kid in school would say, "Hey, Pivnik, why are you still wearing your winter clothes?" Like,
yeah.
And everybody in the classroom erupted in laughter about like me and my winter clothes. And it was humiliating, right? And later on in my, I left that school eventually, and I went to a public school. I remember I had a job and a side hustle, right? So because that's what immigrants do. You're trying to always make money. I was a cashier at a restaurant, and my side hustle was delivering Domino's pizza. One fine Super Bowl Sunday, I'm working while everybody's enjoying the game. I show up at a house, knock on the door with three pies. And who opens the door? It's the same exact kid who made fun of me and my clothes.
Yeah, that asshole.
So
yeah.
As if that wasn't mortifying enough, he gave my broke ass a $20 tip. $20 in 1985. I mean, $20 today
is nice
a large
him,
tip.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? It was to me, it was humiliating. Yeah. And I said to myself, never again. Right. So I think that's when a trigger went off in my head saying, I don't know when. I don't know how, but I'm not going to be low man on the totem pole for the rest of my life.
No, that's so powerful. It's like it basically lit that fire in you. So every time, I'm sure every time something maybe got tough, you thought back to that and said, you know, I'm just gonna hammer this through because I'm not gonna allow that kind of situation to come. So, I mean, thanks for sharing that. So, where did your work outside of working for Domino's and a paper route? Talk a little bit about your work journey.
Sure. So, I dropped out of college because my father had hit upon some hard times and the family just needed assistance financially. So they literally didn't have the time nor the money to send me to college. Instead, my mother found out about this computer programming course being offered, because this is way before the PC age. This is the age of mainframe computers, right? So my mother found out about this course being offered, and I forget the name of it, but it was on Beekman Street in the city. So we called it Beekman 5 because it was 5 Beekman Street. It was a 9-month course. I finished in 6 months, and I got a job programming mainframe computers at a publishing company called Reader's Digest. They're still around today, but they were incredibly popular because there was no internet. This was all, you know, print on magazines. They were super popular back then. And yeah, at the ripe old age of 19, I was programming for Reader's Digest. And yeah, so that's how I started. And then I slowly but surely, you know, continued to upgrade my skill set in the computer world as, you know, computers started to make their way into the marketplace. And yeah, so I had jobs at Reader's Digest, Merrill Lynch, a company called Sealand, which was a logistics, you know, shipping company. And did the corporate world before I got bit by the entrepreneurial bug to branch out.
So for those of you who aren't familiar with mainframe computers are, they're literally the size of like a truck, right? They're massive. Yep. And a lot of the companies you work for were these large companies because they were the only ones who could afford mainframe computers.
Exactly.
And right. Reader's Digest, I think at the time, had something like 50 million subscribers, you know, in print magazine. So yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They had a huge, huge distribution back then.
So at what point did you decide to make the leap and become an entrepreneur?
Yeah, so I think I always had it in me. When I finally had the skill set and computers became much more widespread and popular and, you know, mere mortals can afford them and not just giant corporations, I thought that, you know, offering my skill set and my ability to, you know, small and large companies would be a better professional choice for me than to, you know, stay in the corporate world. So I did just that. I started with a partner and we put an ad in the paper. We literally put an ad in the New York Times and waited for the phone to ring. There was still no email. There were no cell phones. It was literally sitting there waiting for the phone to ring.
Did it ring?
And it rang enough to keep the lights on. And we were doing like various projects. It was super interesting, but the company was directionless, right? Our business plan was to trade time for money. And that's it. If somebody would call and they needed some computer assistance, I'd get on the subway, get into Manhattan to wherever they were, do whatever they needed me to do. It could be a couple of hours worth of work. It could be a couple of weeks worth of work. And then wait for the phone to ring again and rinse and repeat. So that was the project.
You know, going through it from your book, which is fantastic, you know, so you had your first two startups fail, right? So, which, by the way, for a lot of entrepreneurs, that's like one of the biggest fears they have is failure. I mean, let's be honest, a lot of us fear failure. So what went wrong there? And what did you learn from that experience for your third try at Binary Tree, which was a freaking home run?
Yeah, I mean, I learned that, you know, just hope waiting for the phone to ring is really not a good game plan. So that was probably the biggest lesson learned. I mean, I had no idea how to market. Even my first attempt at better marketing, I'll say, failed because my partner and I developed a program for a company on Fashion Avenue in Manhattan on 7th Avenue for this fashion house. And I said, you know what, if this company needs this type of solution to manage invoices, you know, billing, accounts receivable, accounts payable, and inventory, probably all of their competitors up and down 7th Avenue need the same exact software. So I wrote up this little flyer. I went to got the Yellow Pages, and I literally hand-typed 50 or 60 mailing labels and sent out this flyer, and then waited for the phone to ring. Zero. Marketing 101 tells you that you need, you know, seven different touch points at a minimum for somebody to actually open up your stuff, right? And then you know, maybe call you, and then you build up a pipeline, and then a certain percentage of that will close. So that was a failure. So I learned about how not to do things a lot. And what gave me the confidence to try again was meeting a lot of really smart people. And I thought that we would have some leverage in numbers. We were working independently on a project at JP Morgan, and a bunch of great guys and a gal. And I said, hey, you know what? If we pool our resources together and pool our knowledge, the market is really going crazy at this point. We're talking the early 90s now, right? The market is going crazy, paying really high rates for the top-end skill sets for the latest and greatest technology, which at the time was Windows NT as an operating system and C++ as a programming language. So I said, hey, we pool our resources, you know, get really good at these languages. We can start positioning ourselves not as individuals, but as a company offering solutions to customers. So that's what we did, and it worked.
And it was around like a email migration program, right?
So it's interesting. So at first, we were just doing something very similar to what I started doing, which is basically project work, right? So we, instead of selling ourselves individually, we sold ourselves as a company and provided everything, you know, from project management to customer support, implementation services, customizations, all that stuff. But again, still on a project, on a per project basis. Coincidentally, the same company, JP Morgan, hired us as a company to build them this product to migrate their email data. And we said to ourselves, that's a pretty boring project. I mean, who wants to migrate email data? It's boring. But they were paying good money, and we did the project. And at the time, IBM had just acquired an email company called Lotus. Lotus had a product called Lotus Notes, which was the first true enterprise scalable email platform. And that tiny little program that we built for JP Morgan was needed by companies worldwide. So that turned our company into a software company almost overnight.
And then how did the growth go from there? And I'm particularly interested in, Stephen, because, you know, I live in San Francisco. And so, you know, everything skyrocketed with the dot-com boom. But then there's a huge, I mean, everything kind of cratered. So what was that trajectory like for you? And did you have any struggles during the dot-com bust?
Yeah, it was really interesting times because right as while the bubble was still growing, we were approached by a company that didn't want to buy our entire company, but they only wanted to. So our company was basically had two divisions. We had our software company and we had our professional services company. The company that approached us only wanted to buy the professional services company. It was a great opportunity to exit half of the business, go to work for a really experienced management team and be part of a really well-funded organization. They raised at the time $75 million, which is still a lot of money, but at the time raising $75 million was a good raise. So we split the company in half. Me and half of the company went to work for this new company. And then my company called Binary Tree, that remained. Both experienced a lot of turmoil during the dot-com collapse. My bigger company where I was part of, we had to go through, it didn't take us out of business, but we went through many reductions in force. I remember going on conference call after conference call after conference call, laying off hundreds of staff members because we needed to continuously downsize. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, which I did a horrible job of keeping track on because I was very inexperienced as a shareholder and board member at the time. They were experiencing their own troubles, and they were teeter-tottering on bankruptcy.
Yeah, I mean, it was a crazy time. But through all of this, you learned, you know, a bunch of great, you know, obviously great lessons, and you know, with Binary Tree for 27 years. But can you share some practical advice for entrepreneurs, especially around, you know, setting audacious goals and tracking them?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of tracking, and I like to use the analogy of my endurance career, right? When I started on my endurance journey, I started swimming, biking, running, climbing a lot. My sports watch became my best friend because it collected so much data on me, and I loved the reports that were being produced by these apps that endurance athletes use. Two of the most popular ones that are out there are Strava and Training Peaks. if you use your watch to collect data, you're going to get the most incredible reports about your performance. Pace, mileage, altitude, heart rate, VO2 max, sleep patterns, recovery patterns. The list goes on and on, right? And so I started noticing all these reports. I'm like, wow, I have more data about me personally than I have about my company. So I went KPI, key performance indicator, crazy at work. I made sure that every single department started producing monthly KPIs on how they're performing. And within a couple of quarters, you know, performance across the board went up because nobody wanted to come to our newly instituted operational review meeting with their numbers or their KPIs going in the wrong direction. So that's a really long answer to your question. One of my biggest pieces of advice to entrepreneurs is, and this is an old saying, right? But I use it all the time. You can't manage what you don't measure, and you can't improve what you don't measure. So measurements and KPIs, as mundane as it may sound, is incredibly important.
And I think it's only fair to your team as well that, you know, to have a crystal clear vision and direction and the reporting that they can measure themselves against. And I think if you have a great team and great people, they want to be competitive and they want to show up being successful. Nobody wants to be at the bottom of the scoreboard.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, my KPI philosophy is a great segue into the team philosophy, because to your point, great point on accountability. What a lot of entrepreneurs have problems with is managing their team, right? They're incredibly loyal to the people that started the company with them. You know, some of those folks may still be great, but in a lot of cases, they're not as great as they used to be because they were there from the get-go and probably don't have experience running a department at the size that it's become. It's very hard to have that conversation with the best friend that you started your company with, you know, over, you know, emotionally charged subjects versus, hey, you're responsible for professional services. Your utilization rates are plummeting. Your average bill rates are plummeting. The turnover amongst your staff is through the roof. So those are hard numbers, which are undeniable, and much easier to have those conversations based on KPIs versus emotions.
I think when it comes to giving feedback, at any point, you have to have it backed up with facts. Otherwise,
with data
and facts. Otherwise, it's just emotion. And another thing that you brought up there, which I think is so important, and I want to get into your endurance in a second, but a lot of times, which is very tough, and I've seen this even with my family's business as they grew from a $50 million real estate company to a $1 billion real estate company, is, Stephen, the people who got you from 5 million to 10 million and then 10 million to 50 million, they may not be the right people for the team because they lack that experience. So what advice do you have for our listeners? Because we have a lot of entrepreneurs there that it's tough because you want to be loyal to these people because they've helped you get there, but you're doing yourself a disservice by being overly loyal in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing yourself a disservice and you're doing them a disservice as well, because they're probably in a very uncomfortable place. And now that I've been advising, you know, other entrepreneurs after my own exit, I'm advising other entrepreneurs on getting them to an exit. And I've seen this happen, you know, several times, which was almost mirroring what happened in my own company. Loyalty is always there. That's an entrepreneurial and a founder's trait. You're loyal to your staff that got you there. But you're doing your company a disservice if they don't have the necessary experience to bring it to the very next level. And the example I like to use is sales, right? If you have a sales leader that's been with you from day one and has helped you get your company from zero to $10 million in sales and is struggling to get past that $10 million threshold, that's because they've never run a company at above $10 million. You'd be amazed at how a person that has experience, let's say running a $30 million company, can come into yours and, you know, bring it up relatively quickly just because of the playbooks that they have executing at that level. And I hate to pick on sales because I've had some, you know, great hiring decisions on the sales leadership front. I've had some bad ones, but that's a easy, you know, numbers analogy. And the same applies for CFOs, for head of product. It's all, have they managed a company or a group at that scale? And if the answer is no, you're doing yourself and them a disservice.
100%. I'm fortunate right now. I'm experiencing that at Learn It, my company, where we brought in a fractional CRO, who used to run Gong's enterprise team, and just the experience and the playbooks that they have. I just think it's important for the entrepreneurs and the founders out there. You gotta be open minded to be able to accept that and to be able to continue to want to grow. And it's uncomfortable to change, but you gotta shift and make change. You mentioned a little bit because I think this is incredible. You know, your journey with the endurance sports. What triggered that for you?
Yeah, I call it my midlife crisis. I was turning 40. And I realized that I had some really bad genes in me, you know, between my parents and my grandparents, you know, God bless them. I overuse this line all the time. They had it all: high blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, strokes, you name it, they had it, which meant that those genes were in here somewhere. Not that I was unhealthy per se, and my wife hates it when I call myself a couch potato, but I was a couch potato. I really didn't do anything athletically other than ski in the winter occasionally. And totally by coincidence, while I was having all these thoughts about my longevity, somebody at work had completed a triathlon. And I always thought a triathlon was this elite Olympic event for, like, how does a mere mortal compete a triathlon? And I learned that you just go to this website called active.com and you find a race, you swipe your credit card, you sign up, and voila, you can get into a triathlon. And, you know, another switch went off in my head saying, I love this activity. It's going to keep me super, super healthy. And I'm going to pursue this for a long time.
What did you love about it?
I love the challenge. First of all, I mean, I love competing, right? So I'm a relatively competitive person, but I never competed in sports. And what I loved about this is really competition against yourself. You know, I never got to the professional level. I never got to the point where I was near the podium or where there was any prize money involved, but I was competing against myself, right? Competing against my ability to complete a specific distance. It started off with relatively short distances, and then it got to the Ironman distance and actually beyond. So I just love the challenge of, you know, can I get to that finish line before the cutoff time? It became so, and still is, incredibly addictive.
For somebody who might be interested in it, what was the hardest part about getting started for you with endurance sports?
With triathlon specifically, it was the swimming. I wasn't uncomfortable nor scared of the water, but I just didn't have any form nor style nor rhythm in the water. So getting comfortable with first swimming, and then swimming the necessary distances, right? So a sprint triathlon is an 800 meter swim, which is the equivalent of about 32 laps in a 25-yard pool. An Ironman distance triathlon starts with a 2.4-mile swim, which is significant. For me, that was tough, but I overcame that quickly, and now I can swim for miles without a problem. I just did a race earlier this year where it started with a 10K swim, so a 6.2-mile swim.
How much of it do you think is physical versus mental?
Oh, that's everybody says it's as much as mental as it is physical. So if I had to throw a number at it, I'd say 50-50. You know, the physical part is table stakes. You should not attempt this or try it if you don't have the physical ability to endure. But the physical ability alone is not going to get you to the finish line. I mean, it becomes a mental, and every single event that I participated in, I'm probably approaching 100 over 100 at this point, has been a mental game at some point in the race where you have to go like into a really, really deep, dark place and get your head straight.
Whether it's Instagram or on social media, you share a lot of this, right? So our listeners, they could be following you to see what your journey is like on some of these events that you have coming up and everything.
I love to share my lessons learned, and I call it the play-by-play. So I blog about the majority of these crazy races and mountaineering trips that I do. So I've got a blog on my website, stephenpipnik.com, which shares a lot of these stories. And I do share some of my training. Like my big goal right now is to climb Everest in May. So I have a countdown going on Instagram at Stephen Pipnik, where I share the daily, you know, training routine, which is increasing in intensity. I get tired of just talking about the training that I do.
I get tired of just even thinking about it. I mean, it's overwhelming, but it's amazing. Now, before we move on a little bit, you have a great story about your first ultra marathon, which, by the way, is a 50K race. And I think you described it as pure hell. Can you please share with us that story?
Oh, so one of my favorite sayings, thank you for teeing that up, because I love that story. And you know what? I went through my blog and I remembered it was a 50-mile race, not 50K. So it was actually
okay, worse. Okay.
It was 50 miles, not 50K is 32 miles. This was 50 miles.
Hey, let's just stop for a second. 50 miles?
50 miles, like a double marathon.
Oh.
So my favorite saying, one of them, I'm full of them, is anytime you do something for the first time without expert guidance, your results are going to be suboptimal at best or a failure at worst. I'd never ran an ultra marathon before. And I didn't seek out advice from people that did. I just decided to wing it.
You just did it.
I'm like, hey, I've done a marathon before. I've done many marathons. I've done a couple of Ironman. I can go do an ultra. How hard can it be? So I signed up for the Monument Valley 50 miler in Arizona. And at Monument Valley, yeah, Arizona. Beautiful, beautiful national park. Forget about running it. If you just want to go visit, I highly, highly recommend visiting Monument Valley. It is gorgeous. So start running first, right out of the gate. After running, I realized I'm having a really hard time breathing. I'm like, what's going on? Why can't I breathe? It's only been literally a quarter of a mile. I look at my Garmin, my sports watch, and it says that I'm 1 mile above sea level. If you know anything about doing things at altitude, it takes multiple days for your body to acclimatize. So when a sports team plays Denver or in Denver, they arrive 3 to 5 days before the game. So that their body's kind of acclimatized to the reduced amount of oxygen in the air. I literally just arrived the day before, no acclimatization. So I had to get used to the breathing, which was hard. Then, like a few miles in, all of a sudden the dirt trail ends and I'm in deep, deep sand, like super deep sand. So I turn to the guy next to me and I go, dude, what's up with the sand on this course? And he goes, hey, buddy, you didn't read the race guide? 50% of this course is going to be deep sand. Like, great. Now, I mean, as if running 50 miles at higher altitude without
isn't hard enough.
I got to run in sand. So now I'm running in sand, which obviously is taking longer than running on dirt. Then eventually, like the sun goes down, it gets really cold in the desert at night. I didn't bring any cold weather gear. I thought I'd be done with this thing. I knew it was going to take me about at least 10 hours or so. So I'm like, I don't need any cold weather gear. I'm not going to be running at night. I'm freezing. I'm running. My feet are bleeding. I'm cramping up. Now all of a sudden, I'm like, what else can possibly go wrong? It starts hailing. So now it's pitch black. I've got this dinky little headlamp on that's trying to put light on the course so I can, you know, stay on course and not get lost. And I'm dodging a baseball-sized hail that's coming down. And fortunately, that was the end of it. At that point, I was only about 3 miles away from the finish line. But you know what? I was determined to finish that race before the cutoff time. And as hard as it was, as much as I was in pain and bleeding and cramping and freezing, I finished that race before the cutoff time.
Hey, and how did you feel when you finally got to your car and just sat there for a sec?
Oh, it was an incredible feeling of accomplishment. I'm like, you know what? I was proud of myself. I'm like, A, you're a fool for not learning more about the race. And because this day could have gone a lot easier on you if you just did a little bit of homework. So shame on you, but congratulations for, you know, sticking it out and not throwing in the flag, because that's an option in many, many races. You can throw in the flag, right? Actually, in this one, you would have to pay the Indian tribe there to find you in the middle of the night. So there's aid stations every 10 miles or so, but if you just decide to call it,
you gotta
good
find
luck
a station
getting found.
First. Yeah,
you gotta find
right?
You gotta find the station first. So there's plenty of emergency equipment that one can carry, which I did not have at the time because I was silly, in case of these types of events.
And like you said, you can give up in that, just like you can give up as a parent, as an entrepreneur, anything, or you could figure out how to freaking make it happen. What other parallel? I know we talked about measuring, but what other parallels between endurance sports and entrepreneurship do you see?
Oh, there's so many. The list goes on and on. So planning, preparation, execution, pivots, setbacks, stamina, endurance. You know, those seven things that I just rattled off, and there's probably seven more, are applicable in both. And you know, I use the deep experience I've established over the years. If I'm struggling during a race, I start reminiscing about the times I struggled to make payroll, right? When I was struggling to get a product to market, I would reminisce about, you know, struggle to finish a race. And I say, hey, you know what? I had all these obstacles going against me in that example. I can deal with the obstacles that I'm being faced with here. So the two are super, super similar. And I love to say that entrepreneurship is an endurance sport because of all the similarities.
Reflect back, right, Stephen? Reflect back on some of the successes that you made. And sometimes when things are really, really tough, it's important to be able to look back and say, hey, I've done this before. You know, maybe not that specific thing, but you've overcome great challenges. And it's really not a failure unless you throw in the towel.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Ironman has this great video on their website. They have dozens of inspirational videos, but something like quit now and nobody will ever know, but it will haunt you for the rest of your life. You know, don't call me on that. It's not verbatim how their video goes. That's much more
sounds
eloquent
good than
that.
Yeah.
But you get the point. Nobody will know if you throw in the towel, but you'll know, and it's going to bother you. And the few races where I have thrown in the towel, I'm not going to lie, it's bothered me significantly. And I can't help but, you know, think back and kick myself saying, why? I know it was tough, but you could have maybe held on a little bit longer.
Well, you probably reflected back on what you could have done differently and learned from it, because we all, you know, and go from there. One other thing that I hear you talk a lot about, which I agree, you know, I grew up being a baseball player in college. And one thing that they really, and I've used this in my business career now too, is visualizing success. Can you share with us your thoughts around that?
I'm a huge fan of visualization, and I've been doing it from the early days of my company. When I would walk into a sales meeting, I would stop at the front of the building, and my company was started in Manhattan, so these were like in front of Manhattan skyscrapers. I'd stop in the front, close my eyes, and I would envision myself coming back into the same building, this time with this company as my customer. So I just envisioned and manifested success for that sales meeting. And I've been using that same tool for so many different things. My two biggest examples is about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, when I set my sights on selling my company and also qualifying for and competing in the Ironman World Championship, I printed out a check for a specific amount of money and I hung it next to my computer. Printed out a check to made out to me. And I also printed out a poster of Kona, the Ironman World Championship, and I hung it right next to that check. And I saw that in my peripheral vision. And what I love to share is, and this is scientifically proven, the human mind cannot differentiate between an event that actually occurred or one that was properly envisioned. This isn't woo. I mean, this is like a tool that actually works. As long as you do it repeatedly and properly, and you don't need to be an expert. There's a million YouTube videos on how to go through a 5-minute envisioning exercise. When you do it, you're subconsciously programming yourself to make better decisions and to take better actions. So in the case of that selling the company and the world championship, I was actively pursuing those goals, but also subconsciously making all the necessary decisions to make both of those come true.
On the flip side of that is, if you have limiting beliefs and self-doubt and visualize yourself failing, I can promise you that's going to happen, right? If
100%.
You go in that direction.
I think it was Henry Ford that said it. If you think you can, or if you think you can't, you're right.
And so you had that check up there, and then you worked for it, and you ended up selling, you know, exiting Binary Tree. And one of the things that inspired me, that what you said, is that you talked about how, you know, you only see the 1%. Out there, the Googles, the Facebooks, you know, of these companies who are like super successful. But the 99% out there, like yourself, it took 27 years for your exit. I've been at Learnit for 30 years and grinding it out, right? You know, grinding it out, but I still love what I do. And, you know, and whatever happens in the future happens. But so I really appreciate when you say that, right? Because that's if you go in as an entrepreneur and you think that everything is like that 1% that you see on CNBC or Instagram, that's not how it is. I mean, you got to go in understanding that there's the 99% of people like you do that. So share with us when you decided it was time to sell and how you planned to beforehand to make that exit.
Sure. So in my specific case, and this is different for many entrepreneurs, I was at it for so long that, you know, I didn't want to be part of the sale. So I went, and most acquirers insist that the founder or the CEO, you know, stay on because he or she is integral to the operations of the company and part of this big asset. So 3 years prior to the exit, I brought in a CEO to replace. So I basically fired myself, or put it this way, I promoted myself to executive chairman and brought in a CEO to run the day-to-day operations so that when it came time for the sale to occur, the acquirer would see that I was no longer an integral part to the operations. So that was my personal preference, and there's nothing wrong with, and plenty of CEOs stay on or want to stay on, which is totally fine. But in addition to that, I wanted to make sure that our house was in the best shape possible. And by that, I mean our books. I'm a huge fan. There's a chapter in my book called Always Be Closing. And Always Be Closing usually refers to business deals. Always be closing your next sale. I refer to Always Be Closing it as your books, right? So you need to have a very, very buttoned down finance operation where your books can be closed no more than 7 days after the end of the month and at the end of the quarter. And that helps you stay incredibly organized on top of your numbers, on top of your KPIs, make better decisions. But more importantly, it's going to raise the credibility that you build up with an acquiring by an acquiring company, because the courting process is going to last months, some often quarters, and in a lot of cases, years. They're going to be continuously asking for information, right? Whether it's a private equity acquirer or a strategic acquirer, if you can produce that information regularly, really, really quickly after the month ends or the quarter ends, it's just going to build up the credibility on how you run your company. And the analogy I use in the book is like if you come up to a house that has an incredibly well manicured lawn and bushes outside versus one that isn't, it says a lot about the owner. They probably don't care about the insides of their house either if their outside is so messy and unkempt, right? So keep your house, keep that lawn mowed as much as possible in your organization.
Well, 100%, because, you know, private equity or other buyers, they're looking at hundreds of companies and, you know, they get burned quite a bit, right? And so I think an early thing they look at is, you know, are you keeping your books up to date, right? You know, and obviously they look at the executive team because, you know, they want to make sure, you know, that's crucial, right? Because a lot of times that's what you're, one of your main things you're acquiring. But let's move on. You know, let's talk about your book, Built to Finish. You know, we've kind of talked about it a little bit throughout. Who, what inspired you and who's it for?
What inspired me? So when COVID finally ended or was ending and trade shows came back, I went to a trade show and I heard a public speaker. His name was Ed Vischers. His claim to fame was climbing the seven summits without one of the first to climb the seven summits without supplemental oxygen, in addition to a whole bunch of other, you know, climbing feats. And I heard him share his story, and it was so inspirational and motivational. I said to myself, I want to go share my story on stage because I want to inspire others to go do great things because it's not that hard. And I think I built up, you know, a good tool set, you know, to share on stage. And at the end of his presentation, he shared his book. I'm like, okay, so that's the credibility builder. You need a book to build up credibility to get on stage. So I'm going to write a book.
Which
so
is true.
I decided, yeah, exactly, right? So I wanted to memorialize my own journey so that my grandkids and their kids, you know, can read this in the future to see what grandpa did, the crazy nut that grandpa was. But I really wanted to inspire others with the story so that they can set and achieve audacious goals. So that was the motivation behind it, and it's worked. the book is selling well. I get emails randomly saying, "Hey, picked up your book and loved it. Because of you, I'm starting XYZ. Because of you, I decided to finally, you know, get this project going that I've been thinking about forever," which is so incredibly rewarding for like a random person to pick that up. I had a professor call me 3 months ago. She loved the book so much, she made it required reading for her class. I mean, I nearly fell out of my chair. It was amazing. So it was a really, really rewarding project.
Isn't that great? I mean, for you didn't even finish college, and now it's required reading for this professor's class, right? Now, in your book, I think you have 28 chapters. And one of the things I like is you tell your stories, but you also have key takeaways at the end and everything like that. One of the key takeaways or one of the key themes from your book is about resilience and the importance of finishing what you started. Why is that such an important message for you?
It's super important because you want to build up the confidence. You want to build up the confidence machine for future projects. And it's very hard to do so if you don't finish current projects. So, you know, finishing what you started is really important so that you can actually, build up credibility for yourself. Forget about others. I mean, obviously, it's important with others as well. But the most important person you need to impress going forward is yourself. And to build up that confidence, you need to finish things so that you're less afraid to start the next one.
You know, earlier you talked about one of your favorite lines. I kind of forgot what it was. But another thing I heard you say a couple times that resonated with me and I've said for years is that there's no such thing as luck.
Yeah, I love that line. We kind of make our own luck, right? Our luck is based on the decisions that we make, the company that we keep, and the path that we're on, and the grind that we put forward. So, it's so overused, but I love it. The harder I work, the luckier I get. It's 100% true. So, you know, keep putting in the effort. You know, keep making the connections, keep building the network. And things will fall into place. You know, put the word out into the universe about what you're trying to accomplish, and the universe will respond.
One more kind of section I got left for you is, so
yeah, sure.
you sold your business, and what's your advisory? Is it AIP Advisors?
So it's AIP Advisory. That's the name of my advisory firm. And I also work in conjunction with a couple of other organizations. And the main purpose of the advisory is really, I learned this great saying the other day. You are, from an advisory perspective, you are best served to help a younger version of yourself. So I am best served right now to help somebody who is in the shoes I was in, which is running a company, wanting to scale it, and wanting to sell it.
We can do both.
So that they could, exactly. So that they can realize the value of what they created. Because a lot of entrepreneurs have the vast majority of their wealth tied into an illiquid asset, which is their company. And if they've been doing it for a while, like, you know, I was, you are, if they really want to realize that exit, now that I've done it and I've helped others do it, and I work with other advisors that have a lot of experience in this area, it's super rewarding, you know, to help others go along that journey.
And who is your target customer that you like working with?
I would say from a revenue perspective, it's a company doing at least $10 million in annual sales. 10 to, you know, 50 million in annual sales would be my sweet spot. And at least 10 years in business. So they have a, you know, track record behind them. But they're having some scalability issues, that probably having some management team issues. They want to get, for lack of a better word, unstuck and really do the right things over like a 2 to 4 year period to put all the right things into place to maximize their valuation.
And it is a multi-year situation in most cases, you know, for the entrepreneurs out there. It doesn't just happen overnight. So you got to get planning, you got to get going. And I think one thing I would add to that is, because you talk a lot about tough love, you know, you got to be able to give tough love. So I would assume, Stephen, that you also want to work with people who are coachable.
Oh, 100%. And I can't tell you how frustrating it is when I work with individuals that they take copious notes during every single meeting, and then we come back for the next meeting and they haven't implemented one thing. So somebody that's coachable. I mean, I was incredibly coachable, and I think I took most of the advice that I was given, which resulted in a great exit from my company. But if you're not willing to, you know, take advice, then don't bother bringing on an advisor.
No, you're wasting Stephen's time, and you're wasting your own money. I my book is called The Learn It All Leader, and I always talk about the difference between a learn it all and a know it all. A know it all is somebody who they're just not open to change, right? You know, and they're stuck in their ways. And you know, I mentioned it earlier. I met you at the CEO project. I was originally introduced to you by Adam Hill, so thank you, Adam. And then Jim Sletzer invited me to come out. And one thing I noticed, I believe you're a coach there for that group now. And everybody there really respected you. I could just see that, you know, in the interactions. And
thank you.
You're such a humble guy, and I think it's awesome. What other final words do you have for that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean this to be a self-promoting plug, because it could be me, it could be anybody else, because there's plenty of advisors out there. I think I hesitated for a very long time to bring in help. Right. I hesitated for a long time to surround myself with a management team that had more experience than I did. Once I did both of those things, I saw incredible results. So there's no shortage of advisors out there. I'm happy to speak with anybody or recommend them to somebody else if I'm not qualified to help out. But suffering is optional. There's no reason to suffer, and it's lonely at the top for founders and entrepreneurs. Surround yourself with people that have been there, done that, and it's the path is going to become so much smoother.
I had a guest on our show named Rick Jordan, and he talked about paying the dummy tax. You know, that's what, you know, what he had to go through.
I love that.
He had to go through and learn all this, and he's like, well, the next time, you know, he took his company public, he's like, the next time I'll know how to accelerate that. And I also want to give back and share my advice, you know, the dummy tax. One last question before we talk about where people can connect with you at. You got two kids. I've got two kids, much younger, 7 and 3. Yours are your two daughters older. What are you hoping for in the future of leadership for these future generations?
Yeah, I mean, I just hope there's, like we said, this is a great thing to tie back to the very, very beginning. There's so much opportunity in this country. You know, one of my daughters was bitten by the entrepreneurial bug. She quit her corporate job and she started up her own advertising agency. So she moved out of New York. She moved to Miami and she's working for herself, which is fantastic. My other daughter is doing a great job doing speech pathology and, you know, helping a whole bunch of, you know, kids that are in need of her skill set. And there's so much great opportunity out there in this world. People just need to talk to folks that have been there, done that, because like I said, suffering is optional. And that's at whether you're 60 years old or whether you're 26 years old, you can talk to advisors that have done or are doing what you want to do, you know, get the necessary help and go out there and get after it. But don't forget, you're going to have to grind it out. This is my most recent favorite book that I love to recommend. It's called Take the Stairs by Rory Vaden. He's a best-selling author and Hall of Fame speaker. And he just talks about the escalator world that we live in, right? Everybody wants to get there as fast as possible by taking the escalator. But the beauty in the process is in the stairs and the grind, right? So take the stairs, grind it out, and you'll get there in better shape. And I'm not doing this book justice. There's so many great components in that book, which I'm going to reread very often.
Well, I'm going to put it in show notes and I'm going to buy it right after this call. And so, Stephen, I mean, you've been amazing. So many great insights. Where can our listeners connect with you at?
Sure. I mean, the best place is from a business perspective, LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. You can connect with me there. My website is stephenpivnik.com. My email address is there as well. You can sign up for my newsletter and my blog post updates. And I'm pretty active on Instagram at Stephen Pivnik, one word as well.
And let's not forget your journey for Everest in May of 2025. And I'm sure you could follow that on Stephen's blog. So everybody, thank you for tuning in. And I'd like to say, if you got value out of this conversation, what I think you should do, and I'm sure you did, is, you know, copy this episode in Spotify or YouTube or wherever it is and text it to one of your friends and tell them to pick up Stephen's book or just listen to what we had to talk about, because I think there's something in here for everyone, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're somebody who's a couch potato who needs some inspiration to move on with your life, or you're a seasoned executive and maybe you're kind of stuck at a particular level, but you want to get better and you want to grow. So thank you again, Stephen. And until next time, everybody, stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day.